NPR.
From Radio Catskills Studios in Liberty, New York, this is the local edition. I'm Jason Dole. Thank you so much for being here with me this evening. Coming up, we've got the latest on the New York State budget, which isn't much because it still hasn't passed. But we do have the latest, including the fact that this budget is the latest New York State budget has been in 15 years. More on that coming up. Also, Pennsylvania's primary is coming up in just 2 weeks, May 20th. But not everybody can participate due to Pennsylvania's closed primaries. The debate to open the primaries is heating up, though. We talked to Spotlight PA about their live virtual Q&A tomorrow, specifically about the potential of opening primaries in the Commonwealth. And with the May 7th deadline for real ID enforcement fast approaching, how can you get the new ID? And what does it mean if you don't? I'm asking because I haven't gotten mine yet either. Thankfully, Patricio talked to Sullivan County Clerk Russell Reeves, who has all the facts for us, joins us in the second half of the program. But first up, we have news from New York State, where two of New York's top lawmakers are taking aim at each other on national television. Congresswoman Elise Stefanik and Governor Kathy Hochul were both asked recently about facing off in next year's gubernatorial race. North Country Public Radio's Emily Russell reports.
Rumors have been swirling for weeks about Congresswoman Elise Stefanik's next political move. That's after President Donald Trump took her out of the running for UN ambassador last month. It seems Stefanik is pivoting to New York's top political post. The Republican, who lives in Saratoga County, was on Fox News on Sunday, where she was asked about her potential run for governor.
Well, absolutely, I am strongly considering, because look at the crises that Kathy Hochul and single-party Democrat rule have delivered to New Yorkers. And this has been over the period of decades. We have an
Stefanik went on to criticize high tax rates and high levels of out-migration in New York. She said New Yorkers are, quote, yearning for a new generation of leadership.
And the outpouring of support has been tremendous. And Kathy Hochul is the worst governor in America. I dubbed that of Andrew Cuomo, not thinking anybody could make it worse. Kathy Hochul makes the impossible possible. She is the worst governor, and it's showing in her poor, abysmal approval ratings.
Hochul's approval rating has gone up slightly in recent months, from 40 to 44% in the latest poll from Siena College. A day after Stefanik was on Fox, Hochul went on CNN, where she was asked about the potential challenge from Stefanik. Hochul pushed back, saying any Republican who has deep ties to President Donald Trump faces an uphill battle in New York.
Donald Trump has made sure that the Republican Party brand is so tainted in New York that no matter who runs against me, they will have the baggage of explaining why that people's prices went up, why they lost health care, why they lost Medicaid, why they lost education.
Trump's funding cuts have targeted schools. His tariffs have hurt the stock market. Republicans are considering sweeping cuts to Medicaid, which covers more than 190,000 people in the North Country. On CNN on Monday, Hochul said she's ready for next year's election.
I look forward to that fight. No matter who it is, it's not settled yet, but I say bring it on.
The last Republican to win the governor's race in New York was George Pataki when he was reelected in 2002. For the New York Public News Network, I'm Emily Russell.
Thank you, Emily Russell. And now we have the latest on New York's budget, which is the budget is the latest that it's been since 2010. Spectrum News had an article this weekend that pointed out while some lawmakers have been heard saying things like, at least it's not August, and referring to the terminally late budgets of the early aughts, the early 2000s, we are starting to get close to that again. Spectrum's headline read, final touches being applied to latest New York budget since 2010 as good government groups bestow shame. This time last week, we were reacting to Governor Kathy Hochul's announcement that a general budget agreement between legislative leaders had been reached. We're kind of still reacting to that statement. We aren't reacting to the budget being passed because the final budget is not done yet. State leaders acknowledge there's still a number of outstanding issues, and members of the legislature need to vote on the actual budget bills in order for the final budget to be enacted. That part of the process hasn't even started yet. Chantal Destra of New York Now spoke with Jimmy Vielkind of WNYC and the New York Public News Network, as well as Austin Jefferson of City and State New York, to discuss this year's budget cycle and the governor's announcement.
Thank you both so much for joining me here today.
Happy to be here. Thanks for having us.
Now, naturally, I wanted to start with the governor's announcement of a general budget deal between leaders. We know that this does not necessarily mean a final state budget. Lawmakers still need to vote on the actual budget bills before the budget can be enacted. But I wanted to just get your general reaction to that announcement by the governor and the timing of it. What did you make of it?
Well, governors have the prerogative of announcing the budget kind of on their own terms, and that's certainly what we saw Governor Hochul do this week. She wanted to emphasize that the main policy priorities that she saw in this spending plan, in her estimation, she has achieved. That includes some kind of an affordability agenda, which will include rebate checks for middle-class New York families. It includes a bell-to-bell ban on students' cell phone use. It includes changes to the discovery process. That's the way that evidence is shared before a criminal trial. And it also includes changes to the standard by which a person can be involuntarily committed for mental health treatment. And I guess the fifth one is restrictions on the wearing of masks in public. So yeah. Hochul achieved general agreement with legislative leaders on those things. She declared victory. She started touring the state to gain political points.
She did.
And she's left it to lawmakers to work out the rest. Now, that is a break from other years of covering the budget in which you have a gubernatorial announcement generally about 36 hours before bills start getting printed and all the finer points get worked out. So Hochul may have taken that victory lap a little earlier than previous governors. And as we record this, we still have not seen finalized budget legislation. And you're starting to hear some more grumbling by rank and file lawmakers who are wondering when there actually will be a full budget deal.
Yeah, and I wanted to get into some of the policy that have been driving negotiations. We saw a big focus this year around discovery reform. The governor wanted to change how and when prosecutors must turn over evidence in court cases. Meanwhile, members of the legislature felt that there were other ways to address court dismissals without necessarily tinkering with the entire system. So why was this such a contentious issue throughout budget negotiations that ultimately stalled negotiations for some time?
I think for criminal justice reformers, it really felt like going back on that promise to make a more equitable criminal justice system. Because the idea behind, I think, discovery initially was just that, you know, we want to give people who are involved in the justice system a chance at a faster trial, a better chance at, you know, getting their side heard within a trial. And to go back on that by saying, well, only certain kinds of information need to be shared and only on a certain timeline, and now the judge has far more leeway of deciding what is or isn't a sort of, you know, malpractice on the side of a prosecutor. I think to a lot of people, it felt like we're kind of giving up on the idea of giving New Yorkers a chance at getting their side heard in court. I understand why this was important to the governor, but I think if you are someone who hangs their hat on, you know, making a better justice system for New Yorkers, it definitely feels like we're going in the wrong direction.
Absolutely.
I was surprised that this debate occupied so much oxygen in budget talks because it is very, very, very much in the weeds. It's very difficult to understand. I have struggled as a broadcaster to quickly convey to people what we're even talking about. And Austin, you're absolutely right. This is something that was critical and a red alert for people who have advocated for a fairer criminal justice system that gives more rights to criminal defendants. I think from Governor Hochul's perspective, she wanted to be seen as taking a stance that would improve public safety. And so by standing with prosecutors, by standing with New York City district attorneys specifically, who have said that this law resulted in an increase in case dismissals, Hochul is able to say that she took an action that will help increase public safety. Whether it's actually going to work, whether it's actually going to drive things down, that remains to be seen. But going into a 2026 expected reelection campaign for Governor Hochul, she wanted to use this budget to gain achievements upon which she could build a reelection message. And I think, again, having that ability to say, I stood with prosecutors, is something that I expect we're going to be hearing a lot more of from the governor, particularly in the context of a campaign next year.
Yeah, I agree with that. I mean, I think this year more than ever, we saw the governor apply more force than usual, right? Like she brought in district attorneys from across the state to drive home that messaging that there needed to be reforms to discovery law. And she sort of doubled down on her take that a good budget is better than an on-time one. So that was super interesting to me. And we'll see whether or not that was an effective strategy. But I wanted to turn to mask bans across the state. Jimmy, I know you've done some really awesome and thorough reporting on this issue. So can you tell us about the impetus of the proposal by the governor?
Well, this actually started last year. There were some videos that circulated on social media showing pro-Palestinian protesters on New York City subway cars. I think the best way to describe it is harassing riders. And these people were wearing masks. And so that led to concern and outcry, particularly from Jewish groups who said that they're concerned that people are wearing masks under the cloak of anonymity and harassing people who are Jewish, who appear to be Jewish by wearing a skull cap or other religious garb. And Hochul at the time denounced that. And then over the course of budget negotiations, this was sort of a late add for her. There had been a piece of legislation percolating in the state Senate and the Assembly, which would have done two things. It would have created a new crime of quote-unquote masked harassment, and it also would have increased the penalties for people who are wearing a mask to conceal their identity while they are perhaps committing harassment or assault or some other underlying crime. Hochul kind of went all over the place in the course of budget negotiations on this issue. First, she said she backed that piece of legislation. Then we heard that she was softening to say, we just want to have some kind of a penalty enhancer. And that softening happened because it was really difficult for her to explain and for law enforcement to explain, well, your intent is that you're wearing a mask for medical reasons. Yeah. Your intent is that you're wearing a mask for medical reasons. For religious purposes.
Right.
But Jimmy, you're wearing a mask, you're clearly going to harass somebody. You're under arrest, you're not under arrest, you're not under arrest. Mm-hmm. And the potential for disparate enforcement, and particularly how we've seen over time laws where there's discretion for enforcement have impacted black and brown people and low-income people, that led state lawmakers to really push back. So where lawmakers have apparently finally landed, and I have to say we have not actually seen the language mm-hmm. on this deal, was to create an additional charge against a person who commits an underlying serious offense, something like petty larceny, something like harassment, and that if they are wearing a mask to conceal their identity while they are committing said underlying offense, there can be an additional charge against them. So the governor can say, as she did this week, that she is getting tough and putting penalties on people who are using masks to conceal their identity, but hopefully and perhaps avoiding some of those concerns about discretion and disparate impact in the enforcement.
In the last, 30 seconds that we have left, I wanted to hear from each of you if there was anything that surprised you this year in the budget process.
I mean, I think twofold just how long this is taking, only because I think at the start of the year, a lot of us were under the impression that this was a no-frills budget, some pretty straightforward public safety reforms, maybe the self-abandonment we talked about. In theory, should not have taken that much longer than the April 1st deadline, but here we are in May. And beyond that, I mean, I think the housing voucher program that she's been against for years, to bring that back at the last second, seemingly, even if the funding level is much lower than the lawmakers had, initially had in mind, it's a very surprising about face for her, especially since the point being made that affordability could be addressed through this didn't really seem to faze her.
Right. Jimmy?
I agree exactly with what you said, Austin. The Housing Access Voucher Program was a surprise, and the tardiness of this budget was striking to me. That also happened at a time where we're seeing major fiscal risks to New York unfold. The federal government is talking about reducing funding for states through budgetary programs. That's what the rhetoric is from the Trump administration. New York receives more than $90 billion in federal funds in a $250-plus billion spending plan. And also, we're seeing the economic condition become much more uncertain as the impact of President Trump's tariffs roll through the economy and cause gyrations in the stock market. So I was surprised that that was really not part of the conversation as lawmakers were crafting this budget.
Well, unfortunately, that's all the time that we have for this morning. But thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us.
Thanks, Chantel.
Thanks, Chantel.
And we were speaking with Jimmy Vielkind of WNYC and the New York Public News Network, as well as Austin Jefferson of City and State New York.
You're listening to The Local Edition, winner of Excellence in Broadcasting Awards from the New York State Broadcasters Association. Radio Catskill. Listen local.
It is The Local Edition, and I'm Jason Dole. Well, today is May 5th. It's a Monday, and this is the last day for Pennsylvania residents to register to vote in this year's primary election. It's coming up 2 weeks from tomorrow on May 20th. But nearly 1.5 million independent and third-party voters will not have a say in who appears on the November ballot because Pennsylvania remains one of just 10 states with a completely closed primary system. New York, by the way, is another one. The debate over opening Pennsylvania's primaries is heating up. And tomorrow at about this time, it's 6 p.m. tomorrow, May 6th, Spotlight PA is hosting a live virtual Q&A on Zoom featuring lawmakers, election officials, and advocates talking about the potential impact of open primaries. Radio Catskill's Patricio Rubio spoke with Spotlight PA government reporter Kate Huangpu earlier today to learn more about the issue and tomorrow's event. Here's that conversation.
What are some of the most biggest misconceptions about voters have about the Pennsylvania's primary system?
I think the thing that maybe surprises a lot of folks is we're one of only 10 states with a closed primary system. We don't allow voters who aren't registered to the Democratic or Republican primary to fully participate in the primary election. They can still vote on statewide referendums, local ballot initiatives, things like that, but they can't choose candidates that will end up in the fall election.
And in your view, what impact could open primaries have on reducing political polarization in the state of Pennsylvania?
Yeah, advocates for opening up the primary system say that it'll decrease hyperpartisanship. It will allow those median voices to temper the more extremist tendencies of both parties. And beyond that, they also say these are taxpaying registered voters that are being excluded from elections that sometimes can be nonpartisan, right? Like in local elections like this year, candidates for school districts, for local judgeships, they cross files. They register as both Democrats and Republicans. Partisan affiliation doesn't have as much of an impact.
Right. So how are our independents and third party voters sort of responding to being excluded from the process?
Yeah, it's been a long-standing sort of issue. There's been folks advocating on this for at least the past decade, and lawmakers have introduced similar bills over about that amount of time as well, trying to change the system and allow at least independents, so folks that aren't registered to the Democratic or Republican Party or any party, to participate in elections.
So like I say, the primary is happening on the 20th. Any particular races that you are keeping track of in your reporting?
Yeah, I think a lot of folks are looking at the Pittsburgh mayoral race, especially in the context of open primaries, or rather our closed primary system. That's a race where the Democratic primary the winner of that race will likely be the winner of the general election in the fall. Never say never, but because of the way that voters registration is looking in Pittsburgh, it'll be pretty decisive.
You mentioned political folks are double billing. They're getting on all the bills, all the parties, just to have some say in their primary. What role do political parties themselves play in maintaining the status quo in Pennsylvania?
Yeah, in regards to opening primaries, I think there have been lawmakers who support the measure who say that it's a nonpartisan issue, right? It's definitionally not about the two major political parties, but rather it's an issue of leadership where this is the current system. This system is the one that allowed political leaders to get into power. And those lawmakers, those supporters say leadership doesn't want to mess with that. So there isn't an incentive to change the current system. But I think that a lot of folks, like advocates for this issue, would argue that it's more of a matter of democratic principles.
Now, you're having an event coming up tomorrow, May 6th, starting at 6 p.m. on Zoom. It's a live conversation about how open primaries would impact Pennsylvania. You're looking to learn from what you can learn from other states and where the conversation stands in the legislature. Can you tell us, I just read basically the brief description that's posted on the newsletter. Can you tell folks about the program that's happening tomorrow?
Yeah, so it'll be the conversation with a state lawmaker, an advocate, and a county election director. So coming at this issue from a lot of different angles about what the debate is around opening primaries in Pennsylvania and what are the different stakeholders that have to be involved and in the discussion, and talking a little bit more about elections more broadly.
Will it just be you moderating, or are you planning to have a guest on?
Yeah, so I'll be moderating, and then I believe we're having State Rep Jared Solomon, a county election director from Mercer County, and an advocate as well.
Okay, that's great. Now, that's happening tomorrow at 6 p.m. on Zoom. How can folks sign up for this?
Yeah, if you go to spotlightpa.org and our events page, I believe there will be a link that y'all can set up on.
This is something you've been reporting on for a while. Has anything surprised you in the course of reporting on this issue that you may have realized before, or maybe folks don't even realize what's happening?
I don't know if there's anything particularly surprising, just because this has been such a longstanding issue. And I think it's one of those things where it's in line with a slate of election reform issues, right? Like, this maybe isn't the thing that county election directors would most prioritize, but things like pre-canvassing or clarifying mail ballot policies, like, these are things that aren't especially partisan and oftentimes are like administrative changes, but they're a heavy lift in the state legislature just because of how controversial this topic can be. So I think that maybe has tampered any level of, you know, significant surprise. I do think that something that I've been talking to county election directors about is that essentially with open primaries, there is a slight solve where you can just change your registration online and then vote in the primary and then change it right back. So, like, folks can do that. So I think with this, it's more about the intention behind changing this policy, right? What this says about the democratic process.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Like I said, Kate, you'll be on tomorrow on Zoom at starting at 6 p.m. talking about the primary, and will PA ever let independents vote in the primary? That's, again, that starts at 6 p.m. You can sign up through Spotlight PA's website. Kate, anything else before we go?
No, I think that's everything.
Okay, Kate, thank you so much for this. I do really appreciate it. And again, as always, thank you so much for your reporting.
Yeah, of course. Thank you so much.
In Liberty, I'm Patricio Robayo for Radio Catskill.
We're going to wrap up the local edition tonight with our Sullivan County check-in, our weekly check-in, and it includes a big reminder that May 7th is the deadline for real ID enforcement. May 7th, when is that? Oh, that's Wednesday. That's this Wednesday. So if you, like me, like many residents right now, might be seeking clarity on how to obtain the new identification and what it means if we don't, I've got some good news. Radio Catskill's Patricio Robayo sat down with Sullivan County Clerk Russell Reeves for all the details.
It's been extremely busy. All the offices in the state have been extremely busy, and throughout the country, getting people up to standards of the real ID for flying. But one of the most important things I'd like to say is, if you have a passport, you are compliant. You do not need the real ID. And if you're not traveling, a lot of people are confused and think they have to get this license even though they're not traveling. This will not affect your standard regular driving license if you don't get it. It's for flying. So if you're going to fly after May 7th in the country, in the United States, you're going to need a real ID.
And they said if you don't have a real ID, if you have a valid passport, that is still a good way to go also.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. Also, we have another option. There are a few states in the country, New York being one of them, that offer a enhanced driver's license. The enhanced driver's license is also real ID compliant and also allows you to travel by land or by sea into Canada, Mexico, or get onto a cruise ship, and most importantly, let you get back into the country.
That's one of the questions I had, because it's just flying right now. I don't know whether folks needed a real ID to travel, say, for Amtrak or a train across the country or different places. But would it be needed for that?
No, as far as train travel, it's not necessary, but any government building you will need a real ID to get into any government building. So if you want to go to Social Security office or federal buildings, you will need to have either a passport or a real or enhanced license.
A real or enhanced license to get into a government building?
Correct. A federal building.
A federal building.
Not the county building, but a federal building, yes.
So those, I tried to apply for my real ID, and one thing I got stopped on was I don't have a copy of my birth certificate. I'm sure I have it somewhere because I have a passport. But I'm interested in getting a real ID. So what documents do residents need to bring when applying for a real ID?
Well, interestingly enough, you said that you have a passport. So you really don't need the real or enhanced. But let's say you travel back and forth to Canada a lot and you don't want to travel with your passport. You can use your passport as a source document if you don't have your birth certificate. So we can use that in place of a birth certificate if you are applying for a real or enhanced license.
So let's say you don't have a valid passport, you don't have that or any passport. What documents do you have to bring to the DMV?
You will need your birth certificate, which is, I consider that a source document. So you need your birth certificate, you need your Social Security card, and you need a proof of address. In other words, things that are mailed to you that can prove where you live. And everything has to pretty much match. Now, that's the simplified version. What we need to know is the name you were born with, how did you get to the name you're using now through documentation? So if you've been married or you have a name change, you would need, if it's marriage, you would need the marriage certificate. And if it's a name change, you would need those court documents showing that you've changed your name legally.
Right. Okay. Now the deadline is May 7th. Now, will there be a sort of a grace period for folks who may not maybe be in the process of getting one or haven't done it yet?
I have not heard of any grace period. I haven't seen it advertised. It's basically going to be up to the TSA agent what happens if you are there without proper identification.
So what steps have been taken by folks in Sullivan County to make an appointment for, first of all, do you need a written appointment or can you just walk into the DMV?
You need an appointment for the real or enhanced. It's a longer transaction that is normal. If we do an enhanced, it takes two of my staff members to do every enhanced versus one staff member. We've had over 3,775 appointments in the last month. That was just appointments for regular appointments plus walk-ins. So we are very busy. So yes, you need an appointment to get in. We can't handle the onslaught without appointments. The appointment system has been working very well.
And just remind folks, how can folks make an appointment?
You can go right to punch in the Sullivan County Clerk, or you can punch in Sullivan County DMV. And right on the website, you can make an appointment. And when you make that appointment, the basic information of what you need will be right there on that appointment when you make that type of appointment. We also have four mobile locations that we have in place that you can have your real or enhanced done. That's Liberty, Grahamsville, Jeffersonville, and Bloomingburg. So we were able to get that in place, fortunately, before the onslaught of this came about. So those are full service locations also by appointment.
That's great. Like I said, it'd be great for folks who may not make it to Monticello or can't make it to Monticello. You have these mobile places that they could apply for a real ID. Russell, before we go, is there anything else that we have not touched on you want folks to know about the real ID and the application process?
Basically, just to reiterate, and that if you're not traveling, there is some confusion thinking that May 7th, you can't get this license done after May 7th. That is not true. We are going to be continuing to give out these real and enhanced licenses throughout the rest of the year. So there was no stoppage of them being issued. And also, if you have any questions, you can go to the website and you can email us if you have specific questions, and we will get back to you as soon as we can. So we've been extremely busy, and the people of Sullivan County have been great, and my staff has been great. It's been a good process, considering the onslaught and the tremendous amount of people that have been coming through the office. It's a good process. It's just been very busy.
I'm sure it has been. Again, thank you so much. We're talking to Russell Reeves, Sullivan County Clerk, talking about the real ID and the application process as the deadline approaches for May 7th. Russell, again, thank you so much for doing this. I do really appreciate it.
And thank you for having me. It's much appreciated.
In Liberty, I'm Patricio Roballo for Radio Catskill.
Thank you, Patricio. Thank you to all of our guests and the New York Public News Network. And thank you, especially listener, to you for being here to listen tonight to the Local Edition. I've been your host, Jason Dole. I'll be back again tomorrow night. Don't forget, coming up at 7, we've got a 2-hour special in place of our regular programs. And it's the first 100 days of President Trump's second term special presentation from NPR, starting at 7 and going till 9. Before that, we do have The Daily. This is Radio Catskill.
WJFF Jeffersonville. From river to river, mountain to mountain, we are Radio Catskill.